risk. She's not a danger to her society. She has strong community ties. She has no criminal history. And so we're calling for her immediate release while her case continues to make its way through the courts. And this is the same thing that Senators Van Hollen and Kim and other congressmen from her district as well have been calling for. She should not be in that ICE jail for one day longer. Leila. And she faces an imminent risk if she was deported.
Leila Haddad, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian journalist from Gaza, hoping to raise awareness about the ongoing detention of Laqa Qardiya, Palestinian woman from New Jersey, arrested at Columbia University protest. Charges were dropped, but has been held for nearly 10 months in a Texas ICE jail. Many are calling for her release. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Narmeen Maria. An early happy birthday to Raquel Rodriguez Phipps and to Yusra Razuki. I'm Amy Goodman.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query every third Saturday at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And I lose control, think I follow
her. And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Thanks for being with us. This is a very special edition of the KBOO Evening News. It's the best of 2025. From December 24th through January 2nd, we'll be featuring some of our favorite news stories from the past year. I'm Althea Billings, news director here at KBOO, and I'm so pleased to get to showcase some of our work from 2025. Before we do, I want to remind you that KBOO is in our end-of-year campaign, KBOO Fights Back. If you'd like to support local, volunteer-produced reporting, consider donating to KBOO. Every dollar counts. You can go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Thank you. On this edition of the best of the KBOO News in 2025, we'll be taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from KBOO's own Ken Jones. Let's get into it.
Our in-depth guest today is Mary Desch, author, under the pen name M.M. Desch, of the new novel Tangled Darkness. The book is a psychological thriller featuring a woman psychiatrist, which just so happens to be Mary's longtime profession. The character Leslie Schoen finds herself in the middle of an investigation into missing prescription opioids, as well as a murder, and she's the prime suspect in both cases. Tangled Darkness is Mary's first novel and was shortlisted for the 2023 Chanticleer Clue Book Awards. In the words of writer Susie Vitello, Desch deftly weaves a tale of deceit and reckoning. This psychological labyrinth is a gripping page-turner. Well, Mary, first, congratulations on Tangled Darkness, your debut novel. It must be very gratifying to see it in print.
Oh my gosh, I can't tell you. It feels fantastic.
Now, it's been a long journey to the novel's publication, and it starts with what I read, your love of crime and detective fiction, going back to reading Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine as a kid. My parents loved that. We got that, plus Ellery Queen, and my mom never missed an episode of Perry Mason, so I know the feeling. You wrote a blog post on the topic, A Debut Author's Perspective on the Thriller Genre's Enduring Appeal. What's the appeal for you?
You know, it's that question, what is happening here? And I just love the puzzle quality of that.
Oh, yeah, figuring it out.
Yeah, and I tend to go for the character-driven, character-rich thrillers when I'm reading. And so it's always a study in personality, psychology of the characters. And that's, of course, right up my alley.
Now, from your love of crime fiction, and this is where the right up your alley comes in, you took a bit of a detour working as a psychiatrist, specializing in addiction for over 3 decades. Why this path, though I think psychiatry involves a certain amount of detective work?
Well, it really does. Do you know, medical doctors were very important to my family as I was growing up. I was one of 7 kids, and 3 of the kids had cystic fibrosis, which is a very difficult condition. Many children don't survive. And so the family doctor's visit to the house was crucial. And so I felt like I wanted a crucial job. And by age 12, I determined I was going to go to medical school. But once I got there, you know, I was speculating, do I really want to be in primary care? And then I got on this psychiatry rotation at the Veterans Hospital in Omaha. And I tell you, I was just enthralled. I was, what's the word? I was just fascinated by how the differences in people showed up and why. And so that just led me right into psychiatry.
Wow, that was quick. So that pretty much sparked your entire career, just that very first experience with psychiatry.
Yeah, it was amazing. There was more to it. I felt very home or at home amongst the people that worked in mental health, behavioral health care. I came from a family with mental health conditions, and, you know, where several members had mental health conditions, and that was also fascinating to me. You know, what was the underpinnings of why one person might land in a severe depression, but another person in similar circumstances didn't? And so I just really wanted to understand. And I think part of it was I wanted to help my family members. I wanted to learn as much as I could so I could be helpful.
While practicing psychiatry during those 3 decades, were you also writing on the side, fiction or nonfiction?
I wasn't writing fiction. I was writing in my journal. And probably by my early 30s, I discovered the power of journaling. Like, for example, setting out at the beginning of the day what's on your mind or what you have in mind to achieve or to pursue, and then following how, now the language is setting your intention, tended to unfold. Journaling just grew into a habit of mine, sometimes more, sometimes less. But I did not write creative fiction until I retired from practicing medicine. I wrote all kinds of medical reports. I can't even count. But those didn't count.
No, they're not fictional, hopefully.
Right.
Now, of course, all that great experience and knowledge of what you call on your blog, the complexities of the human psyche, led you to writing the new book. When did you start on the manuscript, and what was your initial idea for what became Tangled Darkness?
You know, I finally decided I'm hanging up medicine. It was December 2019. Interesting timing, right before COVID. And I had bought this book. I bought 2 books. They were used books, one for me, one for my wife, Liz. And I showed her the book that I got for her. And she went, I don't think I really want to go for that. Isn't that like 10 years old? And the title of the book was Soul Contracts, something like Realizing Your Divine Potential or something like that, by Carolyn Mace, who's a fantastic author.
I know her. I've read some of her work, yes.
Yeah, she's such a spiritual guru. And so I started leafing through it, and I thought, I'm going to read this. This is perfect for me because I'm in this transition. And what appealed to me too was there was a huge journaling project associated with the book, all these questions. So as I was journaling out and discovering my personal archetypes, all of a sudden characters started to appear in my journaling. And I just got this idea I could write. Now this was as the COVID it was right before the lockdown. And then when the lockdown happened, just a few days later, I talked with Liz about my idea of writing a murder mystery. And I wanted to set it in a mental health clinic. I wanted it to be a small group practice. I wanted to build on the foundation of what I had been through in life. I had invited her to be part of the project, and she, you know, respectfully declined, but supported me in my idea. And that's how it got started.
I love you, but you're on your own. No, I found the writing very polished, especially for a debut novel. And the story was a real page turner. I mean, every blurb I've read says the same thing, and I have to agree. How'd you ramp up on writing a longer work of fiction? Well, going from journal writing to fiction writing, and what resources did you have here in Portland?
You know, that was such a learning project and still is. I was so fortunate to run into many people who were helpful. For example, Angela M. Sanders is a author who's written a couple of murder mystery series. And I'm trying to remember how I got hooked up with her. But I met with her and she told me about Sisters in Crime. And I later joined in a critique group with her. It was kind of a bunch of non-coincidences of how I began to get help. And I had also had this longtime friend, Diane Greenwood, who's now working on publishing, I think, her fourth novel.
Yeah, I've interviewed her for two of the books.
Yeah, and she's fantastic. I just love her. She's been writing for 30 years. She's just such a good friend, and she was very encouraging. She read my beginning pages, the first 60 pages, the first draft, and it was incredible. The feedback she gave me just encouraged me to keep going. Lots of resources. I could go on.
Well, you mentioned a few in the acknowledgments, and some I've interviewed, Laura Stanfill, Diane, you mentioned Nancy Townsley, Susie Vitello, Michael Keefe. So I know there's a real sense of community here, and you got involved with that. The lead character is Leslie Schoen. She's a psychiatrist with a focus on, quote, legally connected mental health cases, which include opioid addiction. And she's a recovering alcoholic, now married to Izzy. You mentioned your wife is named Liz, by the way.
Yeah.
Little similarity. Who's pregnant with their first child. And there's an element of Leslie, of course, in your own experience.
Oh, there's a lot of my personal experience that laid the foundation for the character of Leslie. You know, the setup in the small mental health group practice, the lesbian psychiatrist who's married, her interest, her side interest in forensic psychiatry or medical legal cases was an interest of mine towards the latter half. Or in the latter half of my career in psychiatry. So we have many things in common. And then I started to create.
I was also going to mention the setting, which is right here in Portland. And of course, it has to do with opioids and opioid addiction, and turns out to be a crime syndicate selling stolen prescription opioids. We definitely have a problem in the city with illegal drugs, a growing problem. One character in the book, she's a medical examiner, tells Leslie that over the last 4 years in Multnomah County, opioid-related fatalities increased by more than 25%. And she adds that's after a 30% drop in the previous time frame. Mary, you didn't make up those figures for the book. That's reality.
No, I researched it. And unfortunately, it's so sad to see that the opiate addiction problem just continues to surround us all. All you have to do is, you know, go outside, go to your neighborhood downtown area, go to a neighborhood park, and you can spot who is struggling with addiction. And you can also struggle, or you can also spot who's struggling with, let's say, meth versus fentanyl. So it's just a heartbreaking problem. I tell you, back in my days of practicing, when Suboxone first came out, I thought this is going to be great, because then I was doing a lot of hospital consults, and opiate addicted patients would get admitted to the medical hospital because of abscess or overdose or whatever. And then they'd call in the psychiatry consult, help this person, you know. And I thought, okay, they're going to be landing in withdrawal really soon here. If I could use Suboxone in the hospital, that would be fantastic. So I got credentialed to use Suboxone. A long story made shorter, not long afterwards, a DEA agent showed up in my outpatient office to say, I'm here to investigate your Suboxone practice. So that whole thread in the book is really based on a personal experience.
Yeah, I was interested in that because, of course, you had the background in addiction counseling, the opioid problem, and then you had this incident with the DEA agent. But the book also has characters in the Portland police, medical examiners, even a Mexican drug syndicate. Two very shady characters. How'd you go about doing that research?
Well, with the detectives and police procedure, I had three key areas. One, a good friend who's a retired police commander. We met back in Phoenix. She was actually a neighbor of Liz and mine, and she was one of Liz's personal training clients. And Marty now lives in Ohio and is still a very good friend of ours. So Marty Burkett listened to many of my questions about police procedure and answered a lot of questions. And then this organization, Sisters in Crime, had a week-long intensive workshop on crime scene analysis that was run by a former FBI agent. And so that was extremely helpful.
Wow, what a great background.
Yeah, then finally the forensic part of it, the pathology and the coroner's view and all of that, I have a sister who's a pathologist. So I was calling my sister quite a lot about those events in the book.
It gives the story a lot of credibility. I have one last question, Mary. You previously published a novella, Lethal Loyalty.
Yes.
Which your website describes as setting up book two in the Portland Murders series. That book's titled Play Me Once, Tangled Darkness is book one. Can you tell us about the series and how the stories connect and how many books you plan in the series?
Yeah, so far I have Play Me Once in first draft and ready for edits. I have book three ready in outline form. Yeah, my idea was to try to emulate Tana French as much as I could. Her first four books became the Dublin murder series. And how she did it was she would take a character from book one, let's say, and who was more of a minor character or, you know, not in the forefront, and then make that character the protagonist in book two. So what I'm doing with Tangled Darkness, you'll remember reading, there were several references to Leslie's second cousin Grace, and the book ends.
That's how the book ends. She calls Grace. Yeah.
The book ends with her calling Grace. So in book two, Grace is the protagonist.
Ah.
Oh, and Leslie and her mother-in-law will be part of the book.
Oh, okay. So we haven't seen the last of Leslie shown.
No, and Leslie has a much larger role in book three, as does Detective Davis. Detective Davis will be the protagonist in book three.
Oh, great, because you kind of fall in love with the characters, or certain of them. certain you're happy to see go in one way or another.
Right. And you definitely want to know, you know, what about the baby that Izzy's about to deliver? So I have to follow up with that as well.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to a very special edition of the KBOO Evening News. It's the best of 2025. Today, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from KBOO's own Ken Jones.
Catherine Dunn is one of Portland's literary giants.
Her highly praised and widely read novel, Geek Love, was a finalist for the 1989 National Book Award and was named one of the Atlantic's great American novels. Catherine was an inspiration and mentor to many writers here in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. She died in 2016, but her legacy continues, including here at KABU, where she hosted the show Gremlin Time under the alias of Red Rider. On today's In Depth, we celebrate the publication of Catherine's new book, Near Flesh, which collects 19 of her stories, most previously unpublished, and comes out tomorrow, October 7th. To help us celebrate, we're honored to have two of the people instrumental in bringing these stories to us, Catherine's son, Eli D'Apollonia, and Jim Redden, a local journalist who has contributed to Willamette Week, the Portland Tribune, and Oregon Arts Watch. Eli, as mentioned in the intro, your mom had a show on KABU, Gremlin Time, where she read classic and lesser-known stories, including my personal favorite, Jack London's To Build a Fire. The producer, Matthew Clark, added music and special effects, so it was really radio theater. Were you ever there in the studio with her?
Yes, I think I remember coming in a couple of times when she was recording. I don't remember specifically being there for Jack London's To Build a Fire, but I do remember her reading the story. I remember listening to it and really enjoying it.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you. It's been a few years.
It's clear from Gremlin Time that she loves short fiction. Most people know her from her novels, but she wrote a bunch of stories, though only a few of those were ever published. Were they rejected or just never submitted?
No, she was really focused on trying to get novels published. And she'd always talked about, ever since I was fairly young, she'd always talked about wanting to put together a short story anthology. And she just kind of never really got around to it. She was working on other things, but it was always there. It was always in the back of her mind. It was always something that she'd wanted to do. So I'm glad we were able to finally make that happen.
Now, Jim, you wrote a wonderful article on the new story collection in Catherine's time at KABU in the July Oregon Arts Watch. You point out there's even a character in Geek Love with a show on a Portland radio station not unlike KABU.
That is correct, and I'm sure she was inspired by her time at KABU, including that in Geek Love. More than that, Matt Clark, the producer, had the nickname Fortunato,
right,
which was another character in Geek Love. So there are references to KABU there. People may not be aware that she was here at KABU because she did always appear under the name Red Rider. And she said she was, in an essay she wrote, people were frequently surprised when they met her and realized she was Red Rider because she had such a low speaking voice. Many readers thought she was a man.
You mentioned in your article that when one listener actually met her, he had fallen in love with Red Rider on the radio.
She had fallen.
Oh, she had fallen.
She
sorry.
Had fallen.
She
yes.
had fallen in love and was very disappointed.
Very confused, yes.
Now, in the Arts Watch article, you write about the origin of Near Flesh. This book and the novel Toad, which came out in 2022, owe a lot to a New York book editor, Naomi Huffman.
Correct. She took a real interest in Catherine. She'd been a longtime fan and realized that there was not much else published of Catherine's. And she went online and discovered the archives that are maintained at Lewis and Clark and discovered that there were stories there and contacted Eli to see if he was at all interested in getting any of that published. And he was. And it was a good collaboration, and she was able to do, you know, this collection that comes out tomorrow, the 7th, and previously did the previously unpublished novel Toad.
And Toad, I read, Eli, you actually, it wasn't in the archives. You had a copy that you sent to Naomi, but these stories were.
Well, there was a copy in the archives that was not really legible. And so Jim and D.K. Holm and Bill Redden worked together to make a legible copy that we could send to Naomi. And so that was really the origin of that. It was not in great shape as it was found, but after it was transcribed, it was ready to read and ready for Naomi to look at, and she decided that she liked it and wanted to publish it. And that was really exciting for all of us because Toad had been something that mom wrote back in the 70s and was really, you know, she tried to send it to publishers a few times and had been rejected and was really hurt by that. And it caused her to kind of step away from fiction for a little while. So being able to come back and see it published was really exciting.
Now, you've called the new book, Near Flesh, an opportunity for readers to see stories they might never have access to. Mm-hmm. It allows both her fans and newcomers to experience the wide variety of her writings. What would you say to readers picking up Near Flesh and expecting Geek Love? A lot of people are coming from Geek Love when they read Catherine.
Well, I think that there are certainly stories in there that are consistent with the same sort of level of maturity she had when she wrote Geek Love, or maybe even more so. But a lot of the stories in Near Flesh are stories that she wrote over her entire lifetime. So some of them are stories that she wrote when she was very young. And so it's a real opportunity for people who are interested in her writing to kind of see that evolution and see the changes in her style and see her experiment with different approaches and different styles of writing, because that's something she did throughout her life.
Now, Jim, I'm guessing you're a big Catherine Dunn fan.
Of course.
How were you introduced to her work? Was it through Geek Love, as so many of us were?
Well, I first met Catherine when the two of us were working at Willamette Week. And got to know her back then in the 1980s. Yeah, 1980s.
And she had a column there.
She had a column called The Slice, and she also wrote some stories there, and she would come into the staff meetings we would have every week where everybody would sit around a table and tell what they're working on and things like that. And she was just the most amazing person I'd ever met in my life. She was, you know, funny and, you know, great sense of humor. She was not politically correct. I had a full-time job there as reporter, and she was freelancer. But when she wanted to do a big piece on a professional wrestling scene here in Portland, I served as the editor of that. So I was able to work with her while she was writing something fairly large.
Now, unfortunately, we don't have time to go over individual stories in Near Flesh. There's 19 of them. But I'd like to mention one that should be of special interest to Catherine Dunn fans. The title is Rhonda Discovers Art. Can you tell us a little about that one, why it would be so special to a Dunn reader?
That is a chapter from the book she was working on, Cutman, that was never published. Never finished, and it was originally published in the Paris Review, but has always been available only behind a paywall. So this is the first time that many of her fans can see that for the first time beyond the paywall. But for those people that want a sense of how Cutman was going to turn out and what it was going to be about, that's worth looking at. But Doug Perry at the Oregonian this morning let slip that there's a second unpublished chapter of Cutman also as part of the book, and that is the one that follows, called Screaming Angel. So they're actually, I believe anyway, two chapters in Near Flesh.
Oh, that's kind of a bonus for Catherine Dunn fans. Eli, is there any plans to finish the unfinished novel? I mean, that's been done in the past.
Well, unfortunately, Mom left express instructions that we were not to release the remainder of Cutman or try to finish it. And so I'm trying to honor her wishes in that. You know, there's more than 900 pages of material that no one has seen.
Wow.
And
well, that's difficult for you, isn't it?
She was in the process of kind of cutting it and putting things together and trying to figure out what she wanted to do. And it was a very lengthy process, you know. It was something that she really wanted to be special. And so I understand the frustration of her fans out there that they don't have access to that. And certainly I feel some of that frustration myself. And at the same time, I want to honor her wishes and honor her legacy. And if she felt that it was not ready for public consumption, then I'm going to respect that.
Now, beyond the novel Cutman, there's still a lot of your mom's work published in journals like Willamette Week and quite a few boxing articles, which was a passion of hers. In fact, she boxed.
Absolutely.
And they haven't been collected in books. Are there any plans for a nonfiction anthology?
You know, Jim and I have certainly talked about that in sort of a cursory way. I think that that's something that we may explore in the future.
This is a KBOO Evening News special, the best of 2025. It's also KBOO's end of year campaign. So if our volunteer reporting has meant something to you this year, consider supporting KBOO. 80% of our funds come from members, and you could be one of them. KBOO.fm/give is the online link to donate, but you can also text KBOO to 44321. Let's return to our look back at some of our favorite stories from our resident arts and culture reporter, Ken Jones.
Our in-depth guests today are Gail Pasternak and Deborah Zaslow, two of the editors for the new anthology, The Rooster Princess and Other Tales, Jewish Stories Repopulated, with spunky heroines, wise women, brave crones, and powerful prophetesses from Monkfish Press. Gail's a writer, storyteller, and educator, and an ordained Magida, or Jewish storyteller. She's a founding member of the Jewish Women's Storytelling Collective and serves on the board of directors of Willamette Writers here in Portland. Deborah was also ordained as a Magida and travels nationwide telling stories. She's the author of the memoir Bringing Bubby Home and the audio collection Return Again, which features Jewish stories of healing. Deborah lives in Ashland and has taught at Southern Oregon University for 30 years. Gail and Deborah will be telling a few of the tales from the new book at Eastside Jewish Commons in Portland this Wednesday, September 17th. Deborah, the Jewish religion has a rich tradition of storytelling. The Hebrew term magid means narrator or preacher, and you and Gail are both magida, which is the feminine form. What's the role of a magid or magida?
Well, you know, the role of a magid or a magida is the female has changed over the years, but in Eastern Europe, way, you know, centuries ago, a magid was a kind of traveling teacher who would tell stories to illustrate points and was really a teacher of Torah and a storyteller. And the term nowadays has come to really mean a Jewish storyteller. But it also involves a lot of Torah learning. So in our Magid training program, my husband, who is a rabbi, and I do two parts of the training. I teach the storytelling and he teaches the Torah learning to a group of about, we usually have about 10 or 12 students at a time.
Yeah, going back even further, I looked up Magid on Wikipedia, of course, where I kind of learn everything. It comes from Jewish mysticism and refers to a celestial entity, kind of like an angel, who delivers mystical secrets, sometimes speaking through the mouths of the chosen ones. So that's a lot of responsibility. So the stories you tell, even as a modern day Magida, are not purely for entertainment. There's a spiritual or educational component.
Yeah, and the tradition of Jewish storytelling is associated with stories that are teaching stories. So they have wisdom, but they also have a lot of humor and they're very entertaining. But they are a way of teaching, for sure.
Now, Gail, let's get to the new book, The Rooster Princess and Other Tales, which came out just last week. The subtitle is Jewish Stories Repopulated, with spunky heroines, wise women, brave crones, and powerful prophetesses. Those are all female figures, so it's a different take on the original stories.
Yes. In our Magid class, this was, I think, back in 2020, 2021. We were reading through a lot of the stories, and we started commenting on how few of the stories were about women. And sometimes, I mean, occasionally you might find a story about a really clever woman, but the whole point of the story was to prove that she was worthy of getting married. And In Jewish culture, women aren't like that.
No, definitely not. Deborah, in the book's introduction, you tell the story of how the book came about, and we have to give a lot of credit to your granddaughter.
Yeah, I was working with my granddaughter, and the pandemic had just started. So we were, she was 12, and we were working on storytelling, basically, because we needed, you know, to keep connected. And so I had her pick a Jewish story to tell. I gave her several examples, and she picked one. And the first thing that I have students do, when I've taught storytelling at the university here in Ashland for many years, is make a storyboard. So they do a kind of, you know, stick figure sketch of the scenes in the story. And in order to do that, they have to visualize the characters. And I said to her, how do you visualize, tell me how you visualize Elijah the prophet? This is a very common figure in Jewish storytelling. And she said, I see a woman. And I went, oh, because Elijah is, of course, a male character, Elijah the prophet. But in her imagination, which wasn't, she saw a woman. And I thought, well, why not?
And that's what we have with the book. So thank you to your granddaughter. Gail, you were introduced to several of these stories in their original form growing up in New York. Your family used to tell them around the dining room table. What did you love about hearing them? Was it the content, the way they were told, maybe a mix of both?
Oh, definitely a mix of both. Definitely a mix of both, yeah. And a lot of the stories actually that I heard around the table were personal stories, you know, stories of my ancestors living in Coney Island. My uncle, great uncle's experiences in World War II. And I heard some of these stories. I didn't start really getting into them when I came out here to Oregon. And I wanted to share Jewish culture with my children, but I didn't have an Aunt Sarah or an Uncle Marty who could tell stories of living in Coney Island and all of that. So what could I do? And so I started looking, and I found a lot of these folk tales and stories. And we would read them around at the table every Friday night at Sabbath dinner. And it became a really important part of our family time together.
Now, putting a feminist spin on the tales, I was wondering, was that kind of a balancing act while doing justice to the traditional versions you and many of your readers heard as children? Was that a challenge in putting the stories together and kind of replacing some of the original male characters with women?
Well, for instance, in another story where there was a prophet-like figure, I substituted a character called Sarach Bat Asher, who is one of the characters, a female character that sort of lived forever like Elijah, but is very little known. And in replacing the characters, we didn't just replace characters, we changed the story to a more female-centered view. And we put in different female characters. We didn't necessarily just rename characters. And there's also, we put in some women, strong women in Torah stories, and we added in some personal stories. And there's several completely original modern stories that are Jewish stories, but about Jewish women, but they're not necessarily the traditional ones with just replaced female characters.
Now let's talk about some of your collaborators. You and Gail, Deborah, are listed as the new book's editors along with Deborah Rosenberg. But the author credit goes to, I think, 11 women in the Jewish Women's Storytelling Collective. Can you tell us about the collective, how it started, and what they do? Obviously, they tell stories.
Well, we were all graduates of Magida, Deborah, and Rabbi David's training. And we're different. We're all storytellers, absolutely. Some of us actually work at synagogues, some work at schools, others just tell stories around town, like me. but we're all ordained Magida.
And Deborah, you're an ordained Magida and also train these women and other women to become Magida and tell these, and you yourself, you tell these stories and others across the country. I was just thinking there must be a certain power in that oral tradition, which has lasted thousands of years, telling the stories before a live audience that's different than reading them in a book.
I think storytelling is really different than reading from a book. And a lot of people, I think, in our culture today don't understand, don't even know what storytelling is, because it's kind of a dying art. We know about reading stories. A lot of times if I say I'm a storyteller, people think that that means that I read stories to young children. Not really. Mostly my audiences are mixed or adult. Because my husband's a rabbi, I've been telling stories in synagogues, but we also travel around and do different kinds of storytelling programs. I've told stories in libraries, I've told stories in schools, I've told stories around campfires. There's a lot of venues, and it's quite different because it's a live art. I always say it's a contact sport. When you're telling stories, and you know, when you're reading a book, you're tied to the words in the book. When you tell stories, you don't memorize the words, but you're present with the audience, and you get a feeling, just like if you're speaking spontaneously, it's a back and forth. And so you feel the presence of the audience, and that alters how the shape of the story feels to you and then to the audience, back and forth going on.
And now, Gail, there's no better way to appreciate the power of these tales and the power of storytelling than to hear them for ourselves or a sample, given our time constraints. You very kindly agreed to treat us to one, and the story you picked is Hannah and the Moon, which is, of course, in the book.
Yes.
Would you tell that to us now, and we'll go into that story trance that Deborah talks about.
Deep in the heart of Eastern Europe, there was once a village called Chelm. Now, many considered it a village of fools, but the Chelmites knew they were wise, even if their wisdom looked different from everyone else's. Now, they were a curious people who liked to ask scholarly questions, especially Hannah, the milkmaid. Hannah asked many questions. She couldn't help herself. Every day, she saw wondrous things that she needed to understand. One day, she got up early in the morning to milk her cows, and as she walked to the barn, her feet got wet from the dew on the grass. But later that day, when she delivered milk and cheese, the grass was dry. "Where does the dew come from?" she asked Freda, the woman who worked at the butcher shop. "And where does it go?" "It comes from the tears of the moon," Freda said. "One night, when it gets cold for the moon to warm itself, the moon gets sad and it cries. But during the day, when the sun gets too warm, it drinks up the dew to cool itself." Of course, Hannah thought, Freda was truly the wisest woman in the village. She went home that night and appreciated the cool of the moon. But the next day, she also loved the warmth of the sun. That afternoon, she asked Freda, "What is more important, the sun or the moon?" "The moon, of course," Freda said. "It shines at night when it's needed. The sun, it shines only during the day when it's already light." Now, after that revelation, Hannah gazed up at the sky every night, and the more she did, the more baffled she became. The moon always changed, getting big and full one night and disappearing altogether several weeks later. And oh, those nights when it disappeared, so dark, Hannah often tripped over her neighbor's goat when she went out for a walk in the evening. Now, several weeks later, Hannah visited her cousin in another town, and when she took her evening stroll, she saw these poles with globes of light on top of them. They were like mini moons on every street corner. So when Hannah went back to Chelm, she convinced the elders to call a council meeting, and everyone in Chelm came. "Chelm needs these lamps on the street," Hannah said. "We do," Rachel the lace maker said, and Freda agreed, so did Lipa the water carrier. But the elders of Chelm scratched their chins and shook their heads. The wisest elder stood, "Where will we get the money for these lights on the street? We can't take it from the fund to feed the poor. We can't take it from our schools." And the Chelmites murmured in agreement. "We cannot afford these lamps," they all said. And Hannah thought, "I've got it. We'll steal the moon. Then we can use it whenever we need it." and she told them her plan.
And of course, that's just the first part. So we'll leave listeners with that cliffhanger, how do you steal the moon? Which is answered in the rest of the story.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to a very special edition of the KBOO Evening News. It's the best of 2025. Today, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from KBOO's own Ken Jones.
The annual Portland Book Festival is our city's biggest literary event and one of the most popular on the entire West Coast. This year's festival features onstage discussions with over 100 authors and interviewers, writing workshops, pop-up readings, a very big and popular book fair, and, because it's Portland, a variety of local food trucks. The festival is centered around the Portland Art Museum and spreads across 10 stages at 6 partner venues. This year's author lineup includes Stacey Abrams, Rebecca Yarros, Karen Russell, Omar El Akkad, Megha Majumdar, Lydia Yuknovich, Lainey Zumas, Jess Walter, Renee Watson, Emma Donahue, Craig Thompson, John Raymond, Kimberly King Parsons, Jill Lepore, Cecily Wong, and former Portlander Susan Orlean, to name just a few. In what's become an annual tradition for me, we're fortunate to have Amanda Bullock, Senior Artistic Director at Literary Arts, here to preview the festival. Well, Amanda, this is your 11th Portland Book Festival. What's changed for you from your first festival to this one? Maybe a few lessons learned?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'd like to think I kind of know what I'm doing now. It was all so new the first couple years, because the first year was the first year, and then we grew so much from year one to year two. And then, you know, within the last 5 years, it's been really different every year with going to virtual and back from COVID.
Oh, yeah. You had all virtual festival right after COVID, the pandemic hit.
Yeah. But the last couple years have been more sort of back to normal, you know, and this year I really feel really good about. I think we're coming in really strong and we've gotten a really good response to the lineup. So I think what's different is I just know more. Like, I know more what to expect. There'll always be something unexpected, but I feel more confident going in.
What an incredible lineup. I was going to ask about that. We've talked before about what goes into planning the festival, but that must be a very difficult task to select the lineup of authors among all the books that are published. Then you've got this incredible mix of the well-known, the up-and-coming.
Yeah, that's the goal. And it is difficult. There are so many great books out there. You know, people do also, when you're inviting folks, you do deal with rejection. Not everyone says yes, but a lot of amazing people said yes this year. And I do think it is maybe our strongest lineup. I'm really excited about everybody. And there's great heroes of literature and beyond, like Stacey Abrams, and we were just talking about Karen Russell and folks like that, and then debut novelists and up-and-coming writers and folks in our pop-ups. And I think that is always one of the very best things about a festival, is that you have that mix of people who are both familiar and unfamiliar to different kinds of readers.
Well, let's go into some of that all-star lineup. A good number of them local to Oregon and the Pacific Northwest. And we'll start with one of the names you mentioned, Karen Russell, 2025 National Book Award finalist.
Yay!
And along with Omar El Akkad, both Portland residents and good friends of literary arts. And thanks, Amanda, to one of your wonderful pairings, which you do every year. They'll be appearing together.
They will be, yeah. They're going to be in conversation with Rachel Saslow. And even though Omar's book is nonfiction and Karen's is fiction, I just, you know, saw a lot of common themes in the work. And I really wanted to hear them talk to each other. And so I think other people will, too. And I'm really looking forward to that conversation. I think it'll be really interesting. And just so happens, like you said, that they're both Oregon writers and then had already paired them when they both became National Book Award finalists. So it's really, that's going to be a highlight of the day, I'm very sure.
And Karen's book is the novel The Antidote, which is based on a lot of nonfiction. It's got a real historical basis. Mm-hmm. And Omar's book is called One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This.
Yeah, and both of their books deal with, you know, from very different perspectives, like reckoning with the false promises and potential of America in a lot of ways. And that's a really kind of big topic, and they come at it from different ways, but that's sort of the main thing that I think ties the work together. And I'm, like I said, I'm really looking forward to hear. They're both also just like brilliant, amazing people. And so it's going to be a great conversation.
And not a Portland resident, but there's yet another 2025 National Book Award finalist, Megha Majumdar. Mm-hmm. And she'll be there with her new novel, A Guardian and a Thief.
Yes, Megha is amazing. She is such a great writer. I'm really excited that she's coming. She'll be in conversation with the 2024 National Book Award nonfiction winner, Jason DeLeon. I think that's also going to be great. And then we have Patricia Smith in poetry, is also a National Book Award finalist, and she's at the festival as well. So we have a lot of National Book Award representation this year, which we're excited about.
It's just incredible. Mm-hmm. And speaking of incredible, you have two add-on special event tickets. So these are not included in the general admission festival pass, and these are very popular authors.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, one of them is completely sold out. So the Rebecca Yarros event, she's, of course, the author of the Fourth Wing series, and her newest book is Onyx Storm. She's being interviewed by Lainey Taylor, and that is very much sold out. We had an incredible response to that event. However, we are giving away a pair of tickets to that event at Reader's Night, which is on Friday, November 7th. So,
we'll talk about that.
Yeah, what an opportunity. If you didn't get a chance to get into the Rebecca Yarros event, we are giving away a pair of tickets at Reader's Night. So you will have everyone at Reader's Night will be entered in a drawing to have a chance to win. And then we do still have tickets left as of right now to Stacey Abrams, which is going to be great. She is, you know, known for her political work, but she's also a very talented and pretty prolific writer. She writes romance novels, and then we have her for her thriller series. The newest book is Coded Justice, and she's being interviewed by Dave Miller at the Schnitzer. So that's at noon. You can get in. It's just $5 to get an extra ticket for that. And then we also have some book as ticket available if you want to make sure you're in the front of the hall.
And, of course, we mentioned mixing the well-known and the award finalists and winners with the up-and-comers, lesser-known authors, which is always a big part of the festival for me, a chance to discover someone new. Mm-hmm. Any suggestions for writers who might not be on the average reader's radar?
Yes, definitely. There's a lot. Like I said, all killer, no filler, like hopefully every year, but I think really this year. One of my favorite debuts this year was To the Moon and Back by Eliana Ramage, which is about a woman who wants to be the first Cherokee astronaut. And it's funny, it's great, there's drama and intrigue, and at one point it's like a queer campus novel, and it's just, I loved it so much. And she's in conversation with Anna North, whose last book was Outlawed, and her new book is The Bog Queen. I think that's going to be a really great conversation. And someone else I want to mention is Suvankam Thamavongsa, who's really well known in Canada. She won the Giller Prize for her story collection, How to Pronounce Knife. Her novel is Pick a Color and is really great. And she, I think, is such a wonderful writer. She was one of my very early invites to the festival because I'm just such a big fan of hers. And she'll be in conversation with Portland's own Grace Bancoli and moderated by Cecily Wong. So I think that's also going to be a really strong panel discussion, and I'm excited to hear about those two authors in conversation with each other.
And there's another group of not necessarily lesser known writers, but who don't have their own sessions, but they'll be at pop-up events at the Portland Art Museum, which you do every year, an author doing a reading in front of an appropriate work of art. How do you select people for that and then pair them with artwork at the museum?
Yeah, my colleague Jenna Nishimura curates the pop-up programming, and she's done a really wonderful job this year. The pop-ups are a great way for us to feature some more of the great. It tends to be mostly regionally local authors. We have some folks who are coming from Washington and a little farther afield than the metro area. But we get so many great books, and there's so many great books out there. It's a way for us to include more folks in the festival who we maybe couldn't figure out a good pairing for, or otherwise just kind of couldn't figure out for the kind of main stage pairing lineup. And the pop-ups are one of my very favorite things about the festival, and I think something that really makes Portland Book Festival unique and stand out, because we're able to highlight the art museum and the amazing work there. And I think it's really, I know because they tell me actually, it's really fun for the authors to read in the museum. Jenna makes the pairings, doing her best to thematically connect the visual art with the written work. And so it's also really exciting to to see that come together. And the museum, you know, is on the verge of opening this new pavilion.
Yes.
And so this is a great time to go check it out. And we're really excited about what's to come from the Portland Art Museum. Everybody's festival pass includes admission to the art museum for the day. So it's also really nice to be able to take a break from the literary things and go look at some art. And then because we have the pop-ups, as you're looking at the art, you might stumble on a literary thing. Someone might just start reading poetry while you're in the museum. So
and it, I really think it's fun. More intimate. You're kind of up close with the author. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just a kind of a group gathered around. It's really almost lovely. Like a campfire or something.
Yeah. But it's a work of art. It's great. So that's another thing I really like recommend taking some time in the day to, even if you're not familiar with the people who are doing the pop-ups, just they're all on the second floor. They're all pretty close to each other. Just go over to the museum and check it out. And I would bet that you will encounter something that is meaningful and that is moving for you. So definitely don't miss the pop-ups.
And you always do a great job of including something for everyone at the book festival.
That's the goal.
Covering pretty much all age groups and types of books. And the lineup includes someone I'll be interviewing for my Jonesy show, Brandon Wong, a local writer of middle grade books. Can you talk about, not necessarily Brandon, but the events for kids and young adults, which is a big part of fiction now?
Yes, it's true. Yeah, we have a great YA lineup, and those are, we actually don't have a single YA stage this year. The YA events are spread out so that you could attend all of them time-wise, but they're at a couple different stages, and we're really excited about that. We also have, like, sort of in the YA zone, we host the launch of the anthology of high school student writing that comes out of the Literary Arts Youth Programs, and that will be at the festival at 2 p.m., so you can catch true young adult literature from young adults themselves at the festival. And then our middle grade and picture book programming is at the Judy, which is the home of the Northwest Children's Theater, and is such an amazing space. This is our third year, I believe, at the Judy, and we are so grateful to be partnering with them. It's the perfect place for the kids' programming. So we have picture book story times throughout the day from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. We also have some picture book panels. So if you're someone who's interested in writing picture books yourself, you can hear from these creators about that process. And then we have a bunch of great middle grade programming with folks in conversation, and that's, you know, local authors and national authors, and both picture book and middle grade illustrators will be participating in the very popular illustrator draw-offs, which is a very friendly drawing competition, which is really fun. So I also think the Judy is a great place to stop by, whether you have kids in tow or just a kid at heart. It's a really joyful place to spend some time on festival day.
Now, we mentioned the book fair, always popular, includes a variety of booksellers and publishers. People can buy books there, meet authors, get their book signed. I know a few people here at Indie Presses in Portland. They tell me it's a joy to meet the readers, and they sell a lot of books.
Yes, that's one of our goals. Full price admission includes a $5 voucher, so attendees get $5 that they can spend at the book fair or any of the bookstores. And we started that to really help incentivize book buying. It's really important to us, and it's really important to pretty much everyone that participates in the festival. And it's always more fun when you have, I guess, a souvenir from something. And we encourage you to have as many book souvenirs as you can carry. And I think the exhibitor fair and book fair at the Art Museum is a really great place to get a good picture of the regional publishing landscape. There's some people doing some really, really cool stuff. It's not all publishers. There are kind of book-related goods and nonprofits and different folks in the mix, too. So there's a nice
variety. Grad school programs, too, I think.
Yes, yes. And so it's also a really great place. I'm like, every place is a great place to spend some time. But I think part of what we're highlighting is that the festival isn't just people talking on stage. There's a lot of other things happening that makes it a festival, I think, and different ways for you to have a full and varied day when you're out at the Portland Book Festival.
You've been listening to a very special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2025. In this hour, we've been taking a look back at some of our favorite stories produced by KBOO's resident arts and culture reporter, Ken Jones. My thanks to Ken Jones and to everyone who volunteered with the KBOO News team in 2025. You make it all possible. And of course, we also need to give a thank you to our listeners and our members who support this unique radio station and our new show. We're so proud to get to bring you local, volunteer-produced news every weekday. If you'd like to support KBOO and the evening news, you certainly can. Donate today at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. One last thank you to you out there for listening. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
To KBOO Portland.
Hey, stuck in a slump? Sometimes you gotta shake it out. There's a time for everything.